You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact that you might not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. They make it super simple. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with coverage options tailored to your choices. Plus, you'll see which discounts you may qualify for, like the online quote discount or savings for paying in full. In fact, 99% of Progressive auto customers earn at least one discount. See if you could save when you switch to Progressive. You'll feel good about making a savvy choice. Visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little extra cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary.
Hey, what is up, everybody? And welcome back to Mile Higher. It is me, Josh, and I'm joined by Ian today.
Hello, hello.
No Kendall today. We are attempting to rework our schedule right now, and we had a bit of a scheduling conflict with Kendall, so she won't be on this week, but of course she'll be back next week. But Janelle is here as well.
Hello, everybody.
She is back.
Hey. Hi, Janelle.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Today, we're going to be diving into a very mysterious case, a sad case as well, but Frauke Leibs. Mm-hmm. This is a German case as well, so it was definitely a tougher one to research, right?
Absolutely, but you know, I always prefer those ones, honestly, because it's more exciting when you find new information. You're like, whoa, this is crazy.
Yeah, and there hasn't really been a whole lot of coverage on this case either, especially here in the States. So I forget where I ran across this case, but I was instantly intrigued because she disappears from, you know, a night out after, you know, hanging out with some friends, the World Cup's going on, and it's kind of just this normal night out. Right. And then she just sort of vanishes. But then she pops back up in the form of phone calls and text messages. And these phone calls just get more and more bizarre.
Very bizarre.
As they go on. And it really makes you start wondering what was going on with her. Where was she? Was she potentially being held captive at one point? It's pretty bizarre. And really, there's still a lot of questions as to what happened to her. We know that she was found deceased. Her body was found. But there's still a lot of questions about what happened to her and who murdered her at the end of the day.
I mean, we don't even have a cause of death. You know,
nothing.
There's really very little information surrounding concrete facts of what happened. And I think that's what gives this one such a creepy connotation, because you do have these almost ghostly phone calls with her where she's, according to the people who picked up and spoke to her on the phone, which were her friends and family, they were like, this did not sound like her.
Yeah. And just when you look at the theories, there's just not a whole lot there either. I mean, we'll be talking about this house of horrors, this absolutely insane evil couple that has been sort of brought in as a possible theory, although it sounds like there's obviously not enough there to, you know, make them be the ones directly responsible for her death. But they were doing some very sinister things and committing some heinous murders all in this sort of same time period and kind of same geographical region. But other than that, there's really nothing else.
There's nothing.
There's, you know, kind of just general theories of, like, obviously somebody did this to her, likely a male, but there's really not that much. So it's obviously a case that still needs to be covered because justice has not been served in Frauke's case. And, you know, this person could still be out there, which is also terrifying to think about. So let's go ahead and get into things because this is absolutely insane. So if we go back to June 20th, 2006, Frauke Leibs was enjoying a night out with her friends watching a World Cup game at a packed Irish pub in Paderborn, Germany. The night seemed normal and exciting with Frauke glued to her phone while at the pub. She had been texting with a new boy she had just met and was trying to see him that night. After the game ended, Frauke headed home and eventually texted her roommate to say that she was en route. But the only problem was she was never seen again. And despite Frauke disappearing from thin air, she called her roommate and family numerous times over the following week. She left very strange messages, perhaps even clues to where she was. But years later, with the strange messages, hundreds of people interviewed, and maybe even a connection to some of Germany's most prolific serial killers, the question still remains, what happened to Frauke Leibs? But for a moment, let's go back to the very beginning of Frauke's life. Frauke Leibs was born on February 21st, 1985. She was raised in Lübeck, Germany, and Frauke was one of three children, including her brother Frank and her sister Karen. And while much of Frauke's early life is unknown, we can infer some of what she experienced by looking into the historic town where she grew up. And while certainly small by American standards, with a population of only 220,000 people, it is Germany's 36th largest city out of nearly 2,000. The history of Lübeck dates back to before 819. Very, very old, and it's located on a densely built-up island, and it's Germany's largest UNESCO heritage site. It also has the largest number of tall church towers in the world, and is known as the City of Seven Towers. A beautiful, beautiful place. Germany has some truly remarkable architecture.
Absolutely, and it's because so much of it, it remains from the medieval era. You know,
yeah.
So much. Of course, a lot of it was destroyed during World War II, but for the cities that remain, they're like very untouched.
I mean, the year 819.
Isn't that crazy?
That's even hard to wrap your head around these days. I mean, we're talking, what, over 1,000? Over 1,000 years ago. In Lübeck, there's three universities and a solidly middle-class population. And it really was the ideal place to raise a family. Plus, with the extremely low crime rates, even by German standards, it's one of the safest places. So it's safe to say that at least from the outside, Frauke had a safe and secure childhood, which was reflected by her personality. And throughout her academic career, Frauke was a nursing student and was described as a helper by nature, always going out of her way to lend a helping hand, even to those she didn't know. Following her primary education, Frauke completed a one-year internship at an institution for people with disabilities, which I think says a lot about her character. Which this inspired her passion for nursing, and although she could have continued her academic career in her hometown, Frauke wanted to branch out. This is when she settled on Paderborn, and while it was only an hour and 10 minutes from her hometown, it seemed like the perfect place not only to begin her career, but also to establish a life outside of the town she had known her entire life. And while Paderborn may have had a smaller population than Lübeck, it was far more industrious, with a history of steel and automotive manufacturing, and it also had one of the highest densities of IT jobs and companies in the country. It was also one of the safest cities in Germany, with some calendar years passing by without a single murder. Once again, it was an ideal place for Frauke to start her career. So in October 2005, Frauke moved out of her family home in Lübeck and moved to Paderborn. However, Frauke wasn't making the change completely alone. She was moving in with her close friend, Christos Karolis, whom she always called Chris. Chris and Frauke had been close friends since they attended school together and had even been in a relationship as teenagers, which lasted for about 4 years. And while the two had broken up, they remained very close. Frauke even dated someone else after the relationship, though this one ended as well. And all the while, there were no descriptions of hurt or jealousy from either one of them. It seemed like at the core root of their relationship was friendship, and that extended beyond just sort of the romantic times that they shared. And although the two would be living together and likely closer than ever, they still maintained separate social lives. They socialized in the apartment and went grocery shopping together, but they had their own bedrooms and friends groups and were often engrossed in their studies or social events. And while it is known that Chris had a girlfriend at this time, it's unclear what Frauke's romantic life was like in Paderborn. Even though Frauke had only been in the town for a few months, she had no issues making new friends and was known as an outgoing and confident young woman. According to many, she was well-liked by everyone in her program, and in her social life, she was known for her friendliness and incredibly helpful nature. It's also important to note that while Frauke often went out to bars and clubs with friends, she was never known to go home with someone she had just met, and was intimate only with people she was already in a relationship with, which is as important as we go on. By all accounts, she was very responsible when out on the town. Frauke also had a constant online presence, frequenting the IM platforms ICQ and IRC using the username Sweet Corey. She had made many friends online and had many more she had never met in real life. Her mother said that Frauke always had her phone in her hand and that texting was her number one hobby. One person even said that Frauke chatted with God and the world online. And while this may seem like a bunch of random information, it's all very important, especially in the lead up to June 20th, 2006. Frauke had been living in Paderborn for a few months, and the city was electric as Germany was hosting the World Cup.
June 20th began very routine, with Frauke's mother Ingrid stopping by Paderborn to pick up her daughter for dinner. Chris joined them at a cafe as he had known Frauke's family for several years and wanted to catch up. The conversation was normal and likely revolved around Frauke's studies and, of course, the World Cup. Chris and Frauke had spoken about the German team and both hoped they would not have to face England in the next round. While at dinner, Frauke received a text from her friend and classmate, Isabella, and Isabella said that she and her friends had a spot at a local pub where they were watching the football matches. While Germany had won its match earlier in the day against Ecuador with a final score of 3-0, their group of friends was going to watch the Sweden versus England match together. The next part has conflicting reports. Some say that Frauke's mom dropped Frauke off at the pub before driving Chris back to the apartment and heading back to Lübeck, while others say that Ingrid just left straight from the cafe and Chris was the one who actually dropped Frauke off at the pub. Regardless of what happened, Chris went home because he had an early morning ahead of him, and again, while he and Frauke were close, they maintained separate social circles. These were very much Frauke's friends. Still, Chris had forgotten his key back at the apartment and asked Frauke if he could borrow hers. He told her that he would wait up for her until she returned home. He would leave their apartment door unlocked just in case, but the building's exterior door would remain locked. And I think this section of it, the fact that, you know, Chris took the only key home, it led to early speculation that, you know, he was somehow involved in her disappearance. But again, I think that's basically been debunked at this point in time.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it makes some logical sense to potentially consider him.
Right, he's the closest one to her.
Right, they share a space together and, you know, they're extremely close. And, you know, especially if you look at, you know, the fact they had the past, you know, relationship, right, and maybe there was some jealousy there, but by all accounts, none of that was right. True.
Frauke arrived at the Old Triangle Irish Pub on Leostrasse, where it was packed and rowdy. Not only was Germany a World Cup host, but the German team was one of the favorites, and there was considerable fanfare for every match, even if Germany wasn't involved. And if Frauke's conversation with Chris was any indication, many Germans were watching the English match, hoping they wouldn't have to go against Germany in the next round. The crowd at the pub, although again rowdy, was friendly and engaged with the game. Frauke was having a good time with her friends, but was also constantly texting a guy she had recently met named Niels. While it's unclear if Frauke was interested in a romantic relationship with Niels, she had just been introduced to him through Isabella a few weeks prior. According to Isabella, Frauke and Niels, quote, hit it off, but by all accounts, their relationship was purely platonic at this point. While Frauke was attempting to convince him to come meet them at the pub, Niels was working a late shift and couldn't be there in person. Frauke said he could come by after his shift, but Niels had planned to play pool with a friend at their neighborhood joint. But this wasn't just a simple game of pool. Niels' best friend had recently taken his own life, and Frauke had been supporting him through this time. While Niels often visited the cemetery where his friend was buried, it seemed like he was going to go play pool with another longtime mutual friend who had also known this now departed best friend. And, you know, it was like, it became, you know, pretty clear at this point, Niels doesn't really want to hang out with Frauke, not because he doesn't like her, but because this is supposed to be sort of closure for these two longtime friends after such a traumatic event.
Yeah, it makes sense. So, because Niels will also come up later on when we talk about theories a little bit. Well, let's be honest. Shopping for clothes can either be a lot of fun or it can be the thing you dread. And for me, I'm not good at it and I don't enjoy it. And so the last thing I want to do is scroll the websites, buy a bunch of stuff, get it, and hate it because I didn't get the right size. That drives me nuts. I'm sure that drives you nuts, Ian, too. Like when you order a shirt, you're like super stoked for the shirt you buy and then you get it and it's not what you thought it was.
Well, and especially when these clothing companies are always changing their sizing.
Yeah.
Like throughout the years, I've been buying from the same brands forever. I wear a shirt 10 years ago from this one brand. It's a completely different size. It's even though it's supposed to be the same. It's ridiculous. You don't know what you're buying.
No, it makes it just a painful process. And, you know, I just have stopped doing it because I waste a lot of money buying clothes. And you know what? Why do I need to do that when I've got a personal stylist over at Stitch Fix? The great thing about Stitch Fix is that with your personal stylist, you fill out this online quiz. You tell them what you like, what you don't like. You also tell them what specific pieces you need for your wardrobe. So maybe you've got all the shoes you need, the belts. Maybe you don't need jeans. You can really customize it to get the exact pieces that you want to fill out those missing items. And you know what? It's easy. And I love easy these days. I have very little time for really anything. So Stitch Fix saves me tons of time by just sending me the clothes right to my door that I need, like for the summer. Shorts, tank tops. Need more of those. Always need more t-shirts. I'm a big t-shirt guy. If you can't tell, I'd wear a t-shirt, I think, almost every show, it seems like, because I like to be cool. I would wear lots of layered items if I was recording in a refrigerator, but I'm not. And so I need light clothing.
Well, and the seasons are always changing.
That too.
Always changing.
Stitch Fix makes it super simple. Your stylist picks all the items for you. They send it right to your door. Anything you don't want, they have a prepaid mailer. You just throw the items in there, throw it in the mailbox. It's super easy, simple. And over time, your stylist starts seeing what you like, what you don't like. And so before you know it, you're getting items that you can't refuse and your wardrobe is complete. So get started today at stitchfix.com/milehigher to get $20 off your first order. That's stitchfix.com/milehigher.
At a certain point, Frauke said that she would cook for Niels with Isabella, and he responded, but then you'd have to wear something decent. You know, so they're having this kind of flirtatious back and forth. Everything's going well. And so the game wrapped up at around 11 p.m. with a 2-2 draw, meaning England would not have to face off against Germany in the next round. After the game ended, Frauke expressed to her friends that she wanted to return home as soon as possible for Chris's sake, since she didn't want him to stay up much longer. She hung out for a few moments, but according to her friends, she left just after the game and opted to walk home on foot. It's important to know that this is not an uncommon choice. Paderborn is a very walkable city and extremely safe at all hours of the day. Plus, the walk from the Irish pub to her apartment was only around 20 minutes, so Frauke's friends were completely unconcerned with this decision. Unfortunately, this would be the last time anyone saw Frauke alive.
But it wouldn't be the last time anybody had heard from her. At around 12:49 a.m., nearly 2 hours after the game ended, Frauke texted Chris saying, "Coming later, the game was fun, not against England, smiley face. Love you lots, see you later." Other reports suggest that Frauke said, "coming home later," rather than just "coming," but this is unconfirmed. So Chris, now expecting Frauke home relatively soon, tried to stay up and wait for her. But the hours kept passing and he had responded to her message, but he had heard nothing back. As it got later and later, Chris tried to stay up, but he simply needed to sleep for the early morning ahead. He tried to call Frauke, but there was no answer. And it's unclear whether the call rang through or just went straight to voicemail, which may have suggested that her phone was out of battery. But Chris decided the best move was to sleep with his bedroom door open, hoping to hear the doorbell whenever Frauke arrived. Now, it's unclear whether Chris tried to call Frauke once or multiple times, but we know that he went to sleep either way. The next morning, Chris woke up to discover that Frauke had never returned home, or at least it didn't seem like she had. He hadn't heard the doorbell ring, and Frauke's bedroom appeared untouched, with her bed still made from the day before. Eventually, he received a call on his cell phone. He hoped it was Frauke, but it was her friend Isabella instead. Isabella called to say she was looking for Frauke and she hadn't heard anything from her since she left the pub. And Frauke had failed to show up for their 8 a.m. class, which was completely out of character for her. This put Chris into instant panic mode, and he called anyone who knew Frauke, including her family, asking if they had heard from her. Again, Chris had known Frauke's family for years now and they knew they could trust him. Chris called her mother Ingrid and said that Frauke didn't show up for her class. Again, this worried Ingrid. Not only had she just seen her daughter the day before, but everything seemed completely normal. Ingrid knew that Frauke wouldn't have missed class unless something was very wrong. Now that everyone was aware of the situation, Chris, Isabella, and Frauke's family began analyzing her last known movements and communications with them. First, there was her initial text to Chris saying she was either on her way home or would be soon. And that text was sent at 12:49 a.m. Meanwhile, the soccer match ended around 11 p.m., and Isabella recalled that Frauke left only a few moments after. Even if Isabella was completely wrong and that Frauke left closer to midnight, That still leaves a large chunk of time in which Frauke is completely unaccounted for before she texted Chris. And with this, both Frauke's mother Ingrid and Chris sprang into action. They called the hospitals in Paderborn and nearby cities, hoping to learn anything they could, because they're like, maybe something happened to her. She fell, she got right. hurt, and she's in a hospital somewhere, and that's why we can't get a hold of her. But this led nowhere. And then Ingrid called her local police in Lübeck, hoping to file a missing person report. However, she didn't get the best response. They told her to contact the Paderborn police, and that it was simply too early to report Frauke missing. And despite the initial police inaction, Ingrid contacted a friend on the local police force, who in turn contacted an acquaintance on the Paderborn police. And so this got things going. The Paderborn police began investigating, although it seems like very, very unseriously. That day, they checked for accidents, which turned up nothing. And that was pretty much the extent of their investigation, which is very unfortunate.
Right. I also think a big part of the police inaction as we move forward in this is due to the communications, especially this first text to Chris. They're like, well, you heard from her at 12:49 while she was already out. She's probably drinking. The police don't know her character. They might be assuming, and this is just speculation on my end, but they might be assuming like, oh, she probably went home with someone and that's why you haven't heard from her, as opposed to, you know, what actually took place.
Yeah, and I think especially with this case, you got to think this is a very, very safe place inherently.
Right.
And so you have to think the police are not thinking the worst here. They're thinking, oh, night out, drinking, you know, she's texting you guys. She's probably just staying with somebody. You know,
right.
I don't think their minds go straight to she's in danger, she's in trouble,
right.
Which is always unfortunate in these types of cases, because it's always that one-off instance where maybe if they had taken this more seriously and, you know, did a more thorough sort of search and go talk to people and sort of get last known, contacts she had from the pub, that maybe they would have been able to track her down sooner. But
right.
I think they're just kind of going off their experience. And,
right.
And it's not necessarily inherently because they're negligent or something.
It's just because it doesn't really happen.
It just
here.
Doesn't happen. Yeah.
Right. So instead of an extensive police response, Frauke's friends and family began their own work. They posted flyers later that same day in both her hometown and in Paderborn, asking for any kind of information. And once again, her walk home became heavily scrutinized. As we've previously mentioned, her friends believe that Frauke left the pub just after 11 p.m., and her text to Chris at 12:49 a.m. leaves a nearly two-hour gap in which she's unaccounted for. Perhaps she stopped at another pub on the way home, but there's no evidence of this. However, early on, it was possible that Frauke had tried to see Niels, as she had been texting him all night and was eager to meet up with him. This was easily a lead that the police could have followed up on, but they didn't feel it was necessary. The fact that Frauke had contacted Chris the night before held off a larger investigation, and it wouldn't be the only time Frauke made contact. On June 22nd, at around 10:25 p.m., Chris's phone rang. On the other line, it was Frauke, who was now calling nearly two full days missing. It's important to note here that none of the calls were recorded, as the police weren't investigating the case, and so as a result, we only have Chris's recollection of what was said. After Chris answered the phone, Frauke said, "Hello, Christos. I wanted to say that I'm fine and that I'll be home soon. Tell Mom and Dad and the others." Then she hung up. Chris said she was stunned on the phone, didn't even respond to questions, and then after she said that, she hung up directly, and that was that. I mean, that's kind of a weird call after someone's been missing for 2 days.
Yeah, I mean, and as we'll see the phone calls that happen after this, that the hanging up directly without really responding to anything is definitely the weirdest part of it.
Right.
Because that's just not something that she would have done.
No, if
Chris talking to Chris.
Right.
You know?
And if he would have asked a question, she would have responded, even if she was in a hurry or whatever, you know. Chris said that it was definitely Frauke's voice on the other line, but she didn't sound like herself. She was very monotone, while she was usually quite animated. On top of that, in the entire time they knew one another, Frauke only ever called him Christos when she was angry. At this point, Chris was feeling extremely conflicted. While Frauke had called and there might have been a sense of relief there, she sounded strange and unlike herself, as if it were scripted or recorded. And I think the other thing is, like, perhaps Chris is thinking, or perhaps whoever is with Frauke and might be scripting this call might think that Chris is a brother, you know, and that's why it's like, oh, you call him Christos and bring up, tell mom and dad and the others, you know, instead of tell my mom, tell my dad, call him Chris and all that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, in my head, I'm like, this, the most likely scenario is this is somewhat scripted, or
right,
somebody's telling her what to say. But is there a possibility that she was drugged that night? Was something put in her drink?
Right.
Or is she just, you know, not in a sober mindset at this point still? I don't know, but it is very strange.
So Chris alerted Froke's family to the strange call, who then drove down to Paderborn. Together, they waited in Chris's apartment for Frauke to return. As she has said, she was on her way home, but the hours passed with no further sign of her. They tried once again to call, but there was no answer. Again, details about their attempts are sparse here. We don't know whether the calls rang through or went straight to voicemail, or how many times they attempted to call her. All we know is that they tried to contact Frauke again, and there was no answer. And as they waited, they considered other strange elements to the call. For one, like we said, there's the fact that Frauke said, tell mom and dad, as if she and Chris were related. Perhaps whoever scripted the call didn't realize they were just roommates, or it was an intentionally strange choice made by Frauke to indicate that something was wrong.
Yeah, that's a really good point, too, is that maybe she purposely
right
said that to hopefully set off alarm bells for Chris, like, no, you need to tell my parents. And although it doesn't give a lot of information, but maybe she was signaling in some way.
Right. Like whoever has me doesn't know that we're not related.
Right.
You know, but you do, and you would know I would never speak to you in this way.
Yeah. Yeah. Which if she did do that, that was really smart on her
really
part.
Really smart. And compared to her earlier text to Chris, in which she used exclamation points and emoticons, the tone has completely changed, as if whatever happened took place after that final text to Chris the night she went missing. But still, to the police, this call meant that Frauke was in contact with her family, no matter how strange it was, and they believed it was a good sign that she would return home soon. However, for the family, this was when they first believed that Frauke was being held hostage.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate that the police are sort of just dismissing this when
right.
the family's like, no. This is really weird. She would never say things like this.
Right.
And they're like, oh, no, she's good.
She's good. To them, this is just another phone call. They're like, no, this is a good sign. She's yeah. an adult. She can do whatever she wants.
Yeah, super unfortunate.
So as the days progressed, TV stations began showing Frauke's photos, and the police at this point did begin to work the case by speaking to Frauke's friends, classmates, coworkers, and everyone who was at the pub with her that night. They also finally got in touch with Niels, who said that he had no idea what had happened to Frauke and that he hadn't seen her since the night she disappeared.
And then on Friday, June 23rd, Chris received yet another message from Frauke, this time in text. Frauke, or potentially someone with her phone, texted at around 11:04 p.m., I'm coming back home today. I'm in Paderborn. Chris was with Frauke's brother at the time, Frank, and he immediately called Frauke using his phone. This time, she answered. Frank started the call by saying, Frauke, what are you doing? When are you coming home? And Frauke responded, I'm coming home today, not too late. I'm in Paderborn. Don't ask. I'm coming home. Frank said, where are you then? And Frauke quickly said, I can't say, before she hung up. I think there's definite indicators there that she is with somebody else right. and her calls being monitored.
The fact that she literally says, I can't say.
Yeah. I'm in Paderborn, which is that an indication to, is she actually in Paderborn
right.
or whoever she's with or being held by is telling her to say that to throw everybody off.
Exactly. Like keep your search within the town.
Right. Frank described Frauke's tone as normal, but alert, still cryptic, as if someone was watching her. And now these communications were no longer reassuring the police, and they issued a public statement asking anyone who had seen Frauke or had any information to contact the family. They also began attempting to access any digital evidence related to Frauke and to locate exactly where she was when she made those calls. Then on June 24th at 2:22 p.m., Frauke called Chris once more, while he was with Frauke's family. And this one was immediately striking, as all the previous contacts had been made at night while this one was in the middle of the day. Frauke began the call by saying, "I'm not coming back so late. Come home tonight." Chris said, "Are you hurt?" And Frauke responded, "No, I'm in Paderborn. I'm in Paderborn. I'm in Paderborn." And it's very strange. She repeats Paderborn 3 times. And this caught the attention of everybody immediately, as if Frauke was trying to give them some sort of clue. Frauke's mother described her voice as blurry, which I think is also important to note. Then the next day, June 25th at 10:28 p.m., Frauke called Chris again. And this time she said, "Coming home today." Chris said, "Are you in danger?" And Frauke answered, "No." Chris then asked, "Why didn't you come home yesterday?" And Frauke answered with a question of her own, "Can I explain to you?" Chris asked, "Where are you?" And Frauke responded, "I'll tell you when I'm home." Chris asked one final question, "Who is with you?" And Frauke replied, "I'll tell you later," before she hung up once more. And I think it's like crystal clear to the family, especially, and I'd hope police, that she's either not completely coherent.
Right.
She's potentially being drugged, and that's why she sounds so weird. But I think the more likely scenario is these are incredibly scripted calls.
Right. And she's being monitored.
Yeah. Somebody's listening in and making sure she says exactly what they want her to say.
Right.
Unless you've been living under a rock for the past 10 years, we all know that dealing in cash, checks, really any form of physical payment these days is just not as secure as sending your money through an app. And what app, you say? Cash App. And not only does Cash App have the convenience and security you need to send payment effortlessly from your mobile device to your friends, your neighbors, your mom, your dad, or that random guy that came and fixed your faucet. It's simple, it's easy, but they also have a Cash App card now, which unlocks tons of perks without all the hidden fees. Well, with the Cash App card, you get tons of extra benefits like access to nationwide concert presales, plus discounts on everyday purchases and popular brands you're probably already spending money on, which who doesn't love that? You can add your card to your digital wallet to make your money move easier. But Cash App also adds security to your money by declining suspicious card transactions, sending you a notification to make sure your payment is really you, which this happens more often than you think. I mean, identity theft is real, and you got to do everything you can to protect yourself. You don't want somebody going out spending your money without you knowing. Cash App alerts you, and you can block it before it happens. So you can spend confidently with the Cash App card today. Another cool thing about Cash App is if you direct deposit at least $300 in paychecks each month and then use your Cash App card for purchases, you can earn interest on your savings. And there's no hidden fees and no minimum balance requirements, which I really love that because it's an easy way just to earn free money. So don't let your money sit around and gather dust. Make it work for you. Take advantage of interest savings on the Cash App today. New Cash App customers can earn $10 if you use code CASHAPP10 in their profile at sign up and send $5 to a friend within 14 days. Terms apply.
Cash App is a financial services platform, not a bank. Banking services provided by Cash App's bank partners. Prepaid debit cards issued by Sutton Bank, member FDIC. Cash App Visa debit flex cards issued by Sutton Bank, member FDIC. And the Bancorp Bank N.A. pursuant to a license from Visa USA Inc. See terms and conditions for the Sutton prepaid card, Sutton debit flex card, and Bancorp debit flex card. Cash App Green features savings, direct deposit, roundups, overdraft coverage, and discounts provided by Cash App, a Block Inc. brand. Visit cash.app/legal/podcast for full disclosures.
Then on Tuesday, June 27th, 1 week after Frauke disappeared, she called Chris one last time. This time, Frauke's sister Karen was present. Her mother Ingrid had been over as well, but had just left Chris's apartment. Chris answered the phone saying, "Frauke, Karen is here too." And Frauke asks, "Are mom and dad there too?" Chris said, "They're gone already. Hey, I'll just put you on speaker." Frauke asked, "Is Karen close to you?" And Chris said, "Yes." Frauke said, "I'd like to talk to her, please." And with that, Chris handed the phone to Karen. Karen said, "Hello, Frauke, how are you?" Frauke responded, "Please don't ask." Karen followed up, "Where are you?" And Frauke replied, "I can't say." Karen pleaded, "Come home." And Frauke said, "No, that won't do." Karen asked, "Are you scared?" And Frauke said, "No." Karen asked, "Are you tired?" And Frauke responded, "Yeah, very tired. Please tell everyone I love them very much." Karen asked, "When are you coming home?" And Frauke said, "I've got to hang up. Please hand the phone over to Chris." Chris then asked, "Why did you leave?" And Fraca responded, "You know that, Chris." Chris asked, "Are you being held?" As if whispering, Fraca said, "Yes," very faintly before she said, "No, no," much louder, which that is just, I mean, that tells us everything.
It's chilling.
We need to know. It's very chilling. Chris asks, "You know that the police are looking for you?" And Fraca said, "Yes, I've been away for a week." Chris asks, "Who's with you?" And Fraca said, "I can't say." Chris asks, "Did you meet another guy?" And Fraca replied, "You have to know I haven't been staying away for a week because I met another guy. Come on, you know me. Are mom and dad there too?" And this question seemed very strange, as Chris had already told her that they had been there before but had left the apartment. Chris replied, "They were here." And Fraca said, "Tell them I love them very much." Chris asked, "Should I pick you up?" And Fraca said, "No, that won't do." Chris asked, "Where are you?" And Fraca only responded by saying, "Mama." Chris asked again, "Where are you?" And Fraca once again said, "Mama." He asked again, and Fraca just said, "Mama." Chris asked, "Are you afraid to come home?" And Fraca said, "No." Pleading once more, Chris said, "We'll clean up your apartment and nobody will ask you what happened. Just come home." Fraca said, "That won't do. I'm still alive." Chris asked, "Are you with one or more people?" And Fraca responded, "Please don't ask me. I'd like to be with you all. I'd like to come home." Chris asked, "When will you call again?" And Fraca said, "I'm not sure." Chris said, "Please call every day." And Fraca said, "Yes, I will. Ciao. Bye for now." And unfortunately, this would be Fraca's last phone call. Aside from its length being much longer than all Fraca's other calls, this one contained many cryptic elements, including her faint yes and the repetition of the word mama when Chris kept asking where she was. It's haunting, honestly.
It is.
And I mean, I can't even imagine what Chris, I mean, Chris is obviously, I think, starting to process that she is absolutely being held against her will by somebody who is, I think, trying to make it seem, doing a very poor job, but trying to make it seem like she's okay and she's just off somewhere to try to delay, you know, an investigation or people coming to look for her. But the fact that she, it's like, yes, I'm with somebody, you know.
Right. I don't know.
Dead giveaway.
It's a dead giveaway. And it's, I also can't help but think, this might also be a translation issue, but the way she sounds is very stilted. It's not a natural conversation, mm-hmm. you know? And to me, aside from the monitoring, which I think is certainly happening, and the scripted nature of it, I also wonder if she is like actively in pain on these calls, you know? If, you know, whatever is happening to her is like happening to her right then, and it's hard for her to get the words out.
Or if she's under the influence of something.
Right.
Yeah, I think one of those two possibilities seem very likely, that she's, you know, bound and held somewhere, and, you know, somebody is trying to just delay someone coming to find her, but also maybe give her that last like contact with her family before they do whatever they do with her next. Yeah.
And we don't know their MO. They might honestly just be like really fucking sick.
Yeah.
And just might be deriving pleasure from this.
Totally.
Like, aside from just throwing the cops off, you know?
Yeah. That they're getting off on these conversations and teasing her loved ones. Yeah.
So the lead investigator on Frauke's case believed that the final call was her last cry for help, and she likely knew that this would be the last time she would be able to speak to her family again. After this call, investigators were able to locate which cell towers Frauke's calls pinged off of over the past week. Her first text, which was likely sent before she was abducted or knew that she had been abducted, was sent from Neheim, which is about 22 miles northeast of Paderborn, and would take between 38 to 40 minutes to reach by car. That proved that at some point after leaving the Irish pub, Fraca would have had to be transported by car. Since this seemed to be the only text Fraca sent under her own volition, as it was still in her usual tone, she had likely gotten a ride from someone she knew or someone who had disarmed her suspicion. She likely did not even know that she had been abducted.
Yeah, because her whole plan was to walk home.
Right.
And my guess is somebody came along and likely offered her a ride back home. I mean, it was late, you know, there have been some drinks and just, it's not, you know, the probably the furthest thing from her mind was, I'm going to be abducted tonight.
Right.
And so got into the car, and then this, whoever this person was or persons, then took her out of Paderborn.
Right. And I think, you know, we don't know. All we know is that, like, she was very responsible when she was out. But again, Paderborn is super, super, super safe. And so this might have been a normal thing that, like, yeah, sometimes we get picked up by strangers if they seem nice, and it ends up being okay.
Yeah.
It's also important to note that Frauke's mother had previously taught at a school in Niheim and perhaps repeated the word mama when Chris asked where she was as a kind of clue.
You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact that you might not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. They make it super simple. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with coverage options tailored to your choices. Plus, you'll see which discounts you may qualify for, like the online quote discount or savings for paying in full. In fact, 99% of Progressive auto customers earn at least one discount. See if you could save when you switch to Progressive. You'll feel good about making a savvy choice. Visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little extra cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary.
This episode's brought to you by Rocket Money. For so long, I spent hours, week after week, month after month, combing through my bank statements, trying to track down all those subscriptions, to only find out I had way more than I ever thought I did. But that all changed when I downloaded Rocket Money and set up all my accounts through the beautiful Rocket Money dashboard. And now Rocket Money has become a daily app for me. It's one of the first apps I pop into in the morning because it gives me that peace of mind for the day and for the week that I know where my money is going. Rocket Money has so many great features, like listing out all of your subscriptions. I found out recently I was paying for 2 Disney Plus subscriptions, and it isn't cheap anymore. So I was able to get that canceled with a few taps. Super easy. Rocket Money also does custom budgeting, so you can budget for that family vacation you've been wanting to take. The way Rocket Money looks and organizes all of your finances is one of the reasons why I love it so much and recommend it to absolutely everybody. With Rocket Money, you're able to easily add all of your accounts into one place. And with the premium version, you can even track your net worth. You can also do credit monitoring, which is absolutely essential these days. There's so many great reasons you should be using Rocket Money today. If you're not, then what are you doing? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps you find and cancel unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending and helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster. Join at rocketmoney.com/milehigher. That's rocketmoney.com/milehigher. Check them out today at rocketmoney.com/milehigher.
What's interesting is that many of the following communications had pinged from cell towers in or around Paderborn, and many were very close to the apartment that she shared with Chris. The only exception was the 5th communication, which she made in the afternoon. That call pinged off of a cell tower in Monkalo, which is only a 14-minute drive from Paderborn. It's also important to note that the gap in communication was such that she could have been returned to Niheim between all of these calls and texts. So there's a chance that maybe the central location of where she's being held is Niheim, and she's just being driven throughout during these calls, but we don't know.
Yeah, to attempt to cover up the location, right, and make it seem like she's just out and about.
Right.
Yeah, that seems most likely to me.
The final call was also traced to Paderborn and had been in the direction of Niheim, but it's impossible to know if she was heading there at the time of the call. It was also determined that the culprit had taken Frauke to various parts of Paderborn and the surrounding area to place the calls, like we were saying, in an attempt to confuse investigators. It's also important to note that in June, in this part of Germany, it actually never gets completely dark outside. So even if she was being moved throughout Paderborn, she had to be concealed so she wouldn't be recognized on the street. It may have also helped Frauke to get into a stranger's car, as with all the people out for the World Cup and the lack of darkness, she would have felt a sense of security. For months, there was nothing. Investigators questioned everyone, interviewing over 900 people, including 100 of Frauke's online friends. 40 properties were searched, and the investigation honed in on 5 main suspects. While none of these suspects have been confirmed, we can assume that both Chris and Niels were considered suspects before they were ruled out, along with whoever these other 3 people were. Niels even stated that he understood why the police suspected him at first, and said that his friend's suicide may have served as a motive. because it was a lack of a romantic partner that contributed to him taking his own life, and perhaps Niels saw this as kind of a revenge. Plus, Niels had been close to Frauke, and the two had had a picnic together just 2 days before she went missing. So it's like, this is the guy she's spending the most amount of time with outside of Chris. They're obviously assuming it was a guy who did this. The suicide of his friend was because of, you know, no romantic partner. There's all these elements that police can piece together with Niels, and he sees it himself.
Yeah, I mean, I get it, but it seems like I wonder if they went to all these locations that her phone pinged from,
right.
And you know, or if any of these people, these 900 people, were located in those different spots.
You'd think so. I mean, yeah. It doesn't seem like that big of a metropolitan area.
No, it seems pretty easy to jet over there and
right.
See who's around. Yeah, it's just bizarre, though.
Really weird.
As human beings, we all need to eat, and some of us eat more than others. And some of us just don't like cooking. That's not me, fortunately, but some days I just come home and I'm like, man, I just want a delicious meal on my plate and a lickety split. And you know what?
Uh-huh.
Hungaroot provides that, because Hungaroot makes getting a delicious and nutritious whole meal on the family dinner plates in 15 minutes or less. And I'm not just saying that, I'm saying that from personal experience as a Hungaroot customer. For years now, our family enjoys the Hungaroot meals on the regular. And you know what? I'm always impressed with the quality of the foods. I've never gotten any rancid, moldy food. And sometimes when I shop at the grocery store, that's exactly what I get. I bought a big thing of strawberries from the grocery store and it was mold all the way through it. And that was like an $8 box of strawberries. And you know what? I screamed a little bit because I'm not going back to that grocery store again. What are we doing? Well, Hungaroot, you're getting quality organic produce. You're going to see brands that you've never seen before that you're going to fall in love with. There is this Mexican rice. It's like street corn infused, and it is absolutely delicious from Hungaroot. And the coolest thing about it is you make it in the microwave.
That's nice. That's
easy.
Very nice. Fucking, I always love it when I see a delicious food that says, hey, man, just pop it in the microwave.
Dude, and then there's these spiced Cuban black beans.
Whoa.
That also microwavable. And you know what? I was skeptical at first, but they're absolutely delicious. I don't know what magic they've figured out with these, but absolutely delicious. And our absolute favorite is the sous vide chile limon. Sous vide chicken. And we eat that every single week, and they're great on salads. So we'll do like a chicken salad Caesar at least once or twice a week from Hungaroot. But another thing I love too is there's this lemon pepper half chicken that's sous vide as well.
Lemon pepper, you got me.
And it's just marinating in the packaging.
Mm.
And all you got to do is throw it in a pan into the oven and kind of like heat it up for 15, 20 minutes. And it is so succulent, fall off the bone chicken. I would eat it every day. I love everything about Hungaroot. They make it easy. It's simple. It's customizable for families of all sizes, from 2 people to 4 people or more. You can also customize the ingredients on it. Like, I'll be like, no onions, dude. I don't want that nasty onion in my food. Remove it so that you don't end up wasting food with like some of those other meal kits that don't let you remove ingredients. It's super customizable. It's easy. They screen all their foods. There's no preservatives. There's no high fructose corn syrup. There's nothing that's going to make your body go, ugh. You want to go, yum. And that's exactly what Hungaroot does. So you're going to love Hungaroot as much as I do. For a limited time, get 40% off your first order, plus get a free item in every box for life.
Go to hungaroot.com/milehigher and use code milehigher. That's hungaroot.com/milehigher, code milehigher, to get 40% off your first box and a free item of your choice for life.
Get it.
Get it.
There's one organ in the body that I think most of us forget about. It's not your stomach. It's not your gallbladder.
It's not your skin either.
It's not your skin. It's your liver. And your liver's pretty, pretty important, man. It does a lot.
It's the filter.
It's the filter. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It's constantly working to make sure that your body is getting all the nutrients and filtering out all the bad stuff that you're putting into your body. Because, you know, we all be hitting that fast food every now and then. We know what's in it.
Oh, yeah. We know what's in it. And yet we do it to ourselves every day.
It's just so delicious. But you know what? If you supplement it with some dose, a liquid supplement that is going to give your liver and really your body the boost that it needs. It's not just another capsule or powder. It's a delicious orange juice tasting looking 2-ounce shot. You take a couple times a day and it promotes daily liver functions. It's got zero sugar, zero junk, zero calories, and it really gives your liver everything it needs to work at peak capacity. It's going to help improve energy production, digestion, fat metabolism, vitamin storage, because your liver is processing all these things on the daily and it feels overworked at times. So give it the dose it needs.
You're going to reduce your sluggishness, okay? You're going to get rid of those midday crashes and you're going to support your metabolism and aid your daily digestion. All of the over 500 functions that your liver does, it needs the assist.
Yeah, and I love the fact that it's a liquid supplement. I'm not into capsules. I'm that adult that will break a capsule open and put in some pudding.
Mix it around.
Or water, because I don't like swallowing capsules. So I appreciate that dose thought outside the box and made an orange juice, delicious tasting liquid supplement that is easy to go down. And you know what? You actually enjoy it. You're not gagging and coughing. It tastes great. It's great for your body. You're going to feel better drinking Dose. So ready to give your liver the support it deserves. Head to dosedaily.co/milehigher or enter milehigher to get 35% off your first subscription.
Your body does so much for you. Let's do something for it. That's dosedaily.co/milehigher for 35% off your first month subscription. But then on October 4th, 2006, Frauke's skeletalized body was discovered by a hunter in a remote section of forest near the town of Lichtenau. The area was 10 meters away from a remote country road, which itself was accessed by another remote country road.
And although the remains themselves were unrecognizable, the body was wearing the same clothes that Frauke had worn to the pub the night she disappeared. Investigators believe that the site had been chosen prior to her being there, and the culprit or culprits knew the area well. It was also determined that Frauke had been killed at another location before her body was dumped there, as there was no signs of a struggle near her remains. The weather from the previous 4 months had removed any potential tire tracks or footprints, and investigators were unable to determine a cause of death. There were no signs of stab wounds or gunshot wounds on the remains, and there was no traces of drugs in her system. Though by this point, I mean, skeletalized remains, I mean, it'd be very hard to detect that at that point. Investigators determined that Frauke was killed only days after her final phone call, and the only possibilities for her cause of death would be suffocation or drowning. Investigators did discover a small silver cross near her remains. The killer likely left that, as her family claims she didn't own one. Though it's kind of strange because there is a photo of Frauke wearing a large cross chain, but it appears to be different than the one that they found near her remains. However, items that were not found were her Nokia 6230, her phone, Frauke's fossil watch, wallet, and her black purse. All of these items are still missing to this day, which I think that is a key detail,
right?
Which we'll talk more about later why that is. But investigators did not specify what happened to her underwear, as this could indicate if there is some sexual trauma that occurred. However, this information could have been deliberately withheld. My guess, they probably know that. Right. It just hasn't been released publicly. But an entire police task force was created in Paderborn to try to solve Frauke's murder. They questioned Niels again and stuck to the theory that Frauke may have been picked up en route to the pub where he was playing pool. But still, over the years, Paderborn police have not advanced any theories or evidence. This case didn't fall completely into obscurity, though. After Frauke's disappearance was featured on Germany's version of Unsolved Mysteries, there was a brief resurgence in discussion surrounding the case, and it led many people to ask why the police haven't offered any new information for the past several years. In the absence of new information from the authorities, those online have put forward numerous ideas throughout the years. One of the most pervasive and well-known theories centers on two serial killers who operated out of the nearby town of Höxter. Those who believe this theory even state that the reason there haven't been any updates in the case is that investigators believe that these two killed Frauke but there just isn't enough evidence to connect them to Frauke directly. However, as we'll talk about here in a moment, I think there's still a possibility because when we talk about how little evidence is left and her body was dumped in a remote area, her remains are almost unidentifiable. To me, this speaks to somebody who has more experience in doing, you know, committing a murder like this than, you know, some crime of opportunity guy that just sort of took advantage of her that night. And also the abduction and having her script these lines, I mean, that requires some thought and planning. And so is it possible that these two serial killers, as we'll discuss here in a sec, could perhaps be the ones? But again, there's nothing there that directly ties them.
Right.
But I think it's still something to consider.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about this Hoxter House of Horrors, because this is truly chilling stuff.
So during a snowstorm in April 2016, a car broke down a wall on the road. The drivers, who were Angelica Wagner and Wilfred Wagner, were transporting a 41-year-old woman who was dealing with serious injuries all over her body. As neighbors ran to the vehicle to try to help the woman, the couple called an ambulance and the woman was taken to a nearby hospital where she fell into a coma and later died.
And Angelica is one of the ugliest looking people
fucking,
I've ever seen.
Like that face right there?
That is the face of a disgusting psychopath.
Yeah.
Disgusting.
Disgusting. I don't like looking at her.
No, she's frightening.
What's her fuck ass Lord Farquaad hair?
Yeah, dude. It's like, you really, no wonder you guys didn't leave the house that fucking often.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Teeth, man.
Terrible. Scary.
There's some pictures where her teeth are covered up, but I picked this one because I was like, that's the point. But some of the injuries to the woman, all of which occurred before the drive, were the result of severe abuse and torture. Rotting flesh on her tailbone indicated that the woman had been sitting in the same place for weeks, and she ultimately died from blows to her head.
Eventually, the couple was arrested and charged with her murder, and while Wilfred didn't say anything, Angelica admitted to torturing the woman, as well as many others. Even though the couple had been divorced, they still lived together and had taken the woman captive. And after weeks of holding the woman in their home in Hoxter, she fell and sustained a serious head injury following a beating. They were trying to take her back to her apartment so she could die there, but their car troubles and witnesses coming to help forced them to call the ambulance. When the police searched their home, they described the interior as an indoor garbage dump. They learned that they had been luring women through online ads stating that Wilfred was looking for a companion to live with him and his sister, Angelica. And while there were scores of victims, we're not going to get into all the details there, because it is extremely disturbing, as you can probably imagine. And I will definitely be doing a deep dive on the Hoxter House of Horrors on Lights Out at some point, because there's a whole lot more to this case than what we're touching on here. But let's talk about, like, what's the connection between the Hoxter House of Horrors and Frauke. For one, the police had long suspected that the culprits in Frauke's case were familiar with Hoxter, as it was between Paderborn and Nieheim, and the location in which her body was found as well. Plus, Wilfred had been active since at least 1995 and had often confiscated cell phones and used them to contact the victims' families. Still, Frauke's case didn't quite fit their MO. For one, she wasn't responding to an ad like many of their other victims, and neither Frauke's cell phone nor items of hers were retrieved from the couple's home. Paderborn police have indicated that they believe there's a connection, but they have not made known what that evidence or connection is exactly, and they haven't charged the couple with Frauke's murder. In 2018, Angelica was sentenced to just 13 years in prison, and Wilfred was sentenced to 11 years in a psychiatric ward, though it's claimed that his doctor stated he did not need mental rehabilitation, which, those are light sentences for the atrocious crimes these two were committing. But aside from the Hoxter House of Horrors, there are a few other theories regarding what happened to Frauke Leaves. One online theory proposes that Frauke had a stalker, though we really don't have anything other than that's just a thought.
Just, someone must have been following her.
Some state that someone who lived in the same building as Frauke felt like she was being watched, but this is unconfirmed as well. Because, I mean, with a case as mysterious as this, people are going to come out of the woodworks and every theory you could possibly think of under the sun is going to come out. But as far as we know, police have not really given any concrete evidence or connection to any specific person other than sort of, you know, somebody took her. They think likely, you know, if it's not the Hoxter couple, it was somebody who just, you know, predator that was out lurking that night that took advantage of her as she was walking home, kidnapped her, and then held her captive, potentially assaulted her, and then killed her and dumped her. But there is a 30,000 euro reward for information, obviously leading to this case being solved or the person being arrested. But at the end of the day, we still have no idea who killed Frauke Leibs. And it's just, there's nothing, really.
There's nothing.
There's nothing there other than, you know, running through the list of possibilities. Could this have been multiple people that kidnapped her? Could this have been somebody that had been following her? She had met at the pub, although it sounds like they talked to pretty much everybody at the pub. So it really seems like, in my mind, there is an uncaught killer that is perhaps even another serial killer at that, who is living in the nearby. I don't think this person resides in Paderborn. I think this person resides in a community outside where they can kind of lie low and remain under the radar. But I do, I mean, in some of these serial killer cases, especially the case like the Hoxter house, I think just because it doesn't fit their MO completely, I don't think takes that possibility off the table, because these people are psychopaths and they could have switched it up. They could have even been in town celebrating the World Cup as well. They could have been doing who knows what. And so just because they haven't found direct evidence to link them, I would hope that they don't take them off the table, because you just never know. I mean,
you
could have buried her stuff somewhere. Or this couple seems like, just the fact that they were operating for so long, that they figured out a system to remain undetected for quite a while before eventually getting caught.
Right. I mean, they only got caught really by accident. There was no ongoing investigation into them. There was nothing. It was just because their car broke down with a woman they had tortured. And I also think, you know, the other reason why so many people, maybe even the police, but again, we don't really know, have connected this to the Hoxter couple is because there just isn't that many serial killers in Germany. Like, it's a extremely safe country to live in. And so when something like the Hoxter house takes place, it makes sense for investigators and the public in general to be like, if they operated this well for so long with dozens of victims potentially, you know, what we might as well attribute it to them, because who else would do this to her?
Yeah, and that's probably the way that I would go with it too, because what I go back to is the fact that whoever this person was knew that her cell phone would ping off of towers and the police would use that to track location. And when you look at cases where, you know, it's sort of a crime of opportunity, somebody just decides to take advantage of her that night, and, you know, this is a one-off type situation, you really don't see them taking into account things like, I need to dispose of any digital evidence, any trace of her identity. You just don't see that happen that often, that I really struggle with the idea that this was sort of just some random person who, you know, was, you know, somebody she met, or even somebody who was out, you know, gave her a ride and then, you know, did what they did. And that was it. You know, I feel like that's a very tough thing to keep quiet for this long and cover up with zero trace. And it seems like eventually the police did do a pretty comprehensive investigation and interviewed a lot of people. And so based on all of the different pieces of evidence here, this seems like somebody who has experience, who has know-how to get away with a murder like this, and did it very, very cleanly without leaving any DNA, any sort of like trace of themselves near or around her body. So I don't know. I tend to lean more towards, unless there's another killer that is experienced or uncaught serial killer, which is very possible, it seems to me like I would probably lean towards the Hoxter couple.
Right. I also think, you know, we've seen it before in other cases in the U.S. Where, you know, a serial killer gets attributed to the case and it's almost like universally agreed, okay, this is the person right. who did it, but they're already in jail serving a max sentence. And for them, you know, 11 years is, I mean, 11 and in some change is not much yeah. to us, but that's a huge sentence in Germany. And so I wonder if it's the same sort of thought process where it's like, you know, why would we go through the judicial process to then just really have no additional sentence or anything like that, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, without being completely familiar with the German criminal justice system, my guess is that because they don't have any sort of trace evidence or physical evidence to connect them, that it just wouldn't even be worth trying right. to try them for this murder. And so this is really kind of the best that they can do,
right.
which, you know, for the family's sake, I mean, that's certainly not good enough. And still, it leaves a lot of questions as to who really did this. Without right. the concrete connection, I think you're going to always wonder who did this.
Right.
And there's just no way around it. Janelle, what do you think? Where do you kind of lean with this?
I don't know. I was talking to Ian earlier. I definitely think that she was most likely lured in and didn't know necessarily what she was getting into until it was too late. Whether that was, you know, someone or a couple of people were like, hey, let me get you a ride. Like, where are you going? And, you know, we're just trying to be friendly. Like we said, this was pretty common in that area. It's a very safe area. So I kind of have a feeling that someone convinced her to come with them, get in their car, whatever. And then, yeah, and then, you know, it was unfortunately not someone who was trying to help her. And, and then took her. I don't know if I believe that it was the Hoxter House couple, but I mean, it could be. I don't personally think it was.
Really?
No.
I also think I tend to lean more that way too, because you look at the other thing I think of too is if you take a look at some of the other European serial killer cases, there are other couples that sort of operated like this. And the one thing that kind of sticks out to me is if that night this couple was out prowling and, you know, maybe they were trying other methods for getting victims. I mean, if they rolled up in their car and there's this, you know, older couple in there and they're like, hey. Would you like a ride? There's sort of this false sense of security
right.
when you have a man and a woman in a vehicle that we've seen in other cases that was hugely successful for these serial killers, because having a woman there
yeah.
gives another woman sort of the false yeah, sense of 100%. Security. And I think that could be a possibility of what happened here, that maybe they were out on, you know, out in the town in Paderborn and you know, were looking for a victim.
Right.
And they just came across Frauke, and Frauke was, you know, just walking home. But if a couple rolls up, it does give you this sort of false sense of, like, even if you don't know them, that, like, you know, it's probably okay.
Right.
Versus like a random guy.
Or even just a solo woman. I mean, like, yeah, yeah, there would still be more security there. But I really do think the fact that it's a couple
yes.
makes it be almost like parental in a way.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah. And we've seen that before. There's, you know, the Moores murders, a very classic case of a couple that's exactly what they did. They took advantage of the fact that, you know, young boys would see, you know, a woman and she would be the one to lure the victim into their vehicle. Right. Then they would take them. And so I think it's very possible that it was them, because I just, again, the evidence is so little. There's no DNA. Her remains weren't found for a period of time. How was that location accessed? If this was somebody that just made that split decision that night to kidnap her and then on the fly made up this entire plan, is kind of tough.
Well, it was a pretty elaborate plan.
Yeah.
It wasn't, I don't think it was someone who just was like,
crime of opportunity.
Right. Like, oh, wow, a single girl. Let me see what I can do. Because, I mean, the phone calls and all that just makes it seem like this was very strategically planned out. Ian, I was going to ask, how many couple or how many people do we know for sure were victims of the two?
I would have to look it up. I do believe it's like, again, it's a ton. It's theorized to be in the dozens. But in terms of their conviction, I think it might actually only be the one woman.
Okay. So, and they obviously admitted to that.
Right.
The fact that there's that question mark there still is, I mean, who knows how many?
Right.
And just because they found the house of horrors, that doesn't mean they also committed other horrors outside of the house, and they just haven't discovered that.
Yeah, true. It seems like there's a lot of unknown about these two.
Yes. And so it looks like it's two directly like convicted.
Yeah.
And then at least six other women that are right. attributed to them. But then if you include victims like Frauke into that, then that goes up and up and up and up.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to get into that case because I'd like to get in deep and see and learn more about that. And it will add some further clarity around Frauke's case and just if that information is even available. But yeah, I think really the two possibilities, it was either this couple or there is some other uncaught predator that is seemingly experienced in, right. in the way that they go about doing things. And potentially even a serial killer. And yeah, it's terrifying that person could still be out there.
I mean,
I was just going to say, I think also the fact that unfortunately she was found unrecognizable and skeletal yeah. remains makes it so much harder because it sounds like these two were definitely torturing and doing horrific things to people. And so if her body could have been discovered earlier, I think that would have helped a lot. Because we could figure out, okay, and what condition was her body in when right. she was left? But
yeah.
we'll never know, which is really, really unfortunate.
Yeah. Too much time passed in between when she disappeared and when she was found, and all that valuable evidence is just gone, unfortunately. But yeah, this case is still open, technically, and how much work is being done on it, I don't know. I'd hope that they still are keeping an eye out, because again, you never know. There might still be somebody out there who's responsible for this that has never been brought to justice. And so that's why it's important to keep this, you know, keep Frauke's story alive and, you know, allow people to never forget it because, you know, it seems like she was an incredible person as well and, you know, had everything going for her and had just an amazing life ahead of her and sounds just like a really cool person
right.
and somebody who is going to do a lot of good for the world and for people. And somebody stole that from her. And that person should pay at the end of the day. Somebody should pay for what they did to Frauke. And I hope they do. But let us know your thoughts below. I'm really curious to see which way you lean with this as far as what you think happened to Frauke. But that is going to be it for us today. Appreciate you being here. We'll be back next week with Kendall for another case. But until then, keep on taking your mind a mile higher.